Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting and understandable. I'm John Wells and with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. We have a fascinating show for you this morning. Our first guest is Eric Schlosser, author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. Investigative journalist Eric Schlosser digs deep to uncover secrets about the management of America's nuclear arsenal, a groundbreaking account of accidents, near misses, extraordinary heroism, and technological breakthroughs. Command and Control explores the dilemma that has existed since the dawn of the nuclear age. How do we deploy weapons of mass destruction without being destroyed by them?
And good morning. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. And our second guest this morning is John Marsluff. He's a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington. Now, John studies the behavior of crows. Playful, yes, crows the bird, the black one. Playful, social, and passionate, crows have brains that are huge for their body size, which allows them to think, plan, and reconsider their actions. They also exhibit an avian kind of eloquence, mate for life, and associate with relatives and neighbors for years. And to people who care for crows and feed them, they often give oddly touching gifts in return. How curious. The ongoing connection between humans and crows, a cultural co-evolution, has shaped both species for millions of years. We need to talk about this, John.
And I'm looking forward to it, Lynn. Our third guests this morning are Neil Patwari and Brad Mager, two University of Utah electrical engineers that have developed a network of wireless sensors that can detect a person falling. This monitoring technology could be linked to a service that would call emergency help for the elderly without requiring them to wear monitoring devices. Secrets of America's Nuclear Arsenal, Crows, and I've Fallen and I Can't Get Up, when we return on Cool Science Radio.
350 Main Brasserie is pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves Chef Carl Fiesinger's Low Country Cuisine nightly at 5:30 p.m. You can contact us at 649-3140. Our website is 350main.com with reservation, menu, and contact information.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Our first guest is Eric Schlosser. He's the author of the new book, Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. Eric is also the very well-known author of the New York Times bestseller, Fast Food Nation, and also Reefer Madness. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, Monthly, Rolling Stone, The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, and The Nation. And in his new book, Schlosser investigates the many near misses that could have caused catastrophes. And this book is getting a lot of buzz, an extreme amount of buzz, since it was released just last week. And welcome to Cool Science Radio, Eric Schlosser.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Eric, at the crux of your book, you recount in really blow by blow, I mean, edge of your seat kind of detail, an incident in Damascus involving the release of weapons of mass destruction. Now, ironically, you're not talking about Damascus, Syria. You're talking Damascus, Arkansas, home of the Titan II missile complex. So, and also you're referring to an incident that happened about 33 years ago involving a socket wrench. Tell us about that.
Well, there was a repairman doing routine maintenance on a Titan II missile in a silo in Damascus, Arkansas. And he had to put a socket on his wrench in order to loosen a fuel cap, pressure cap. Routine thing, happened all the time. The socket fell off the wrench. It hit the work platform he was standing on, bounced. He reached out for it, missed it. And it fell between this really narrow gap in between the platform and the missile. He was standing near the top of the missile. The socket fell about 70 feet, ricocheted off part of the silo, hit the missile, pierced the skin of the missile, and cut a hole in it, releasing thousands of gallons of rocket fuel into the silo. Very toxic, very lethal, very explosive rocket fuel. Now, I talked to other repairmen. You could drop that socket 1,000 times from that platform trying to hit the missile.
Right.
And never achieve it. So it was a completely freak accident, but it created a very dangerous situation. This was the largest intercontinental ballistic missile the United States ever built, and on top of it was the most powerful nuclear warhead the United States ever put on a missile. That warhead had an explosive force of 9 megatons. And what that means is it was 3 times more powerful than all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War, including both atomic bombs. And the Air Force didn't know what to do as soon as this accident happened because nothing like it had ever happened before.
So crisis was somehow averted. Crisis wasn't really averted, but there wasn't mass destruction. And, you know, I'm wondering, did people know about it? You know, you wrote that motorists passing by didn't even know it occurred. Did the government keep it, you know, hush-hush?
No, people knew about it. There was a massive explosion, and the whole area was evacuated. And flames shot, it's not clear, but at least 1,000 feet into the air. And the nuclear warhead was lost for some time, and people were injured. The reason that we don't remember it is it was a big news story for about a day.
Mm.
The Air Force was adamant that there was no possibility that this warhead could have detonated. And at the time, President Carter was up for re-election against Ronald Reagan. The hostages were being held in Iran. And this was a news story that lasted about a day. But through my reporting and through my research, it's apparent now that warhead could, in fact, have detonated. And if it had detonated, it would have destroyed most of the state of Arkansas and sent lethal radioactive fallout up the eastern coast of the United States. And it's one of those things that, you know, the course of history would have changed.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton was the governor at the time. He was in Hot Springs, not all that far away. Vice President Mondale was in Arkansas that day.
Mm.
Chelsea Clinton was a little one-year-old baby. And, you know, it's remarkable that that ended well.
Huh. It's an amazing story. And the way you wrote it with all the detail and talking about the volatility of the fuels when they mix and those sorts of things. I mean, there are other stories, too. And many books chronicling the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the Cold War have been written by those in charge, the people with the power, president,
yeah.
Secretary of State. But your book is refreshingly different. It is written from the perspective of the service person who
yeah.
risks their lives to avert these types of disasters. What prompted you to write the book this way?
You know, I was spending time with the Air Force after I wrote Fast Food Nation, and an officer I was spending time with told me the story of the Damascus accident, and I just thought it was an unbelievable story. I couldn't believe I'd never heard about it, but the details of it were extraordinary. So I set out to track down some of the people who were there. And I spent time with them, and I was struck by the incredible personal courage of the people who were trying to prevent a nuclear catastrophe. But even beyond that, throughout the Cold War, and I think we've done a disservice to many of these servicemen. You know, in the films, the Strategic Air Command officers, and they're always depicted as these right-wing, crazy warmongers. There were thousands of people who served, who risked their lives, sometimes lost them, and sacrificed a great deal in their personal life in order to prevent nuclear catastrophes like this one and in order to prevent a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. And I thought their stories were fascinating. There have been many, many books written on nuclear weapons that look at Oppenheimer and Teller and the famous Manhattan Project scientists. But what was interesting to me was the day-in, day-out management of our nuclear weapons by the people who handled them every day, whether they were bomber pilots, bomber crew members, nuclear weapon repairmen, nuclear weapon designers. One of the people I profile in the book is a bomb squad technician whose job it was, if there was a broken arrow, a serious nuclear weapons accident, it's his job to go over to a damaged nuclear weapon and defuse it. Now, that takes some nerve to do.
It sure does. How many broken arrows have occurred in the last 30 years?
Well, you know, the official list of broken arrows put out by the Department of Defense lists 32 serious accidents that threaten the public involving a nuclear weapon. But when you look more closely at that list, you know, some of those accidents did not involve a fully assembled nuclear weapon and posed no risk whatsoever of a detonation, whereas through the Freedom of Information Act and through interviews with weapons scientists from the big weapons laboratories, there were many, many more accidents than 32 in which a weapon could have detonated, an American weapon detonating accidentally on American soil. Now, the Damascus accident I wrote about at greatest length because so many of the bigger themes of the book are evident in the story, and it's also, I think, a great story. But I talk about other accidents in the book that could have led to detonations. And sometimes, you know, a very simple, mundane thing, not a plane crash or a missile, you know, fire, could set off a weapon. A short circuit inside the weapon. You know, improperly unloading a weapon from an aircraft could arm it. And once the weapon's armed, if you drop it from, you know, 5 or 6 feet, it could conceivably detonate. And those things happened a lot. There's no way to conclusively say how many serious nuclear weapons accidents or incidents we had. There was one document that I got from the Sandia National Laboratory, and it mentioned 1,200 nuclear weapons involved in accidents from, I think, 1950 to 1968.
Wow.
So a lot. We had a number of serious close calls.
We're speaking with Eric Schlosser, who has written a fascinating wake-up call titled Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusions of Safety.
Now, Eric, you also, I mean, there are many anecdotes in the story. Another one that I recalled is an atomic bomb in South Carolina that's dropped without a detonating device in this family's backyard. And their doctor who treats them tells about it.
Yeah. You know, that was one of the accidents that could not have led to a detonation because the weapon wasn't fully assembled. But it sure scared the hell out of his family.
Oh, yeah.
They were just at their house in the suburbs, and suddenly there was a massive explosion in their yard, and it dug a huge crater. And none of them were seriously hurt. You know, windows were blown out of their house. Their brand new car was destroyed. But it turned out that there had been an Air Force plane flying overhead. There were problems with the weapon being properly locked into the plane, and it fell, and the high explosives in the weapon detonated. But it was also a pretty scary story for one of the crew members of the plane, because a light had come on in the plane saying that the weapon wasn't properly secured. He was ordered to go into the bomb bay of the plane, which was flying at, I don't know, 10,000 feet, 11,000 feet, 15,000 feet, and he had to climb into the bomb bay to make sure that the weapon was properly attached. While he was leaning on the weapon and looking to see if it was properly attached, and this sounds like something out of Strangelove, the weapon fell from its mounting, hit the bomb bay doors, and he fell with it. He was able to grab onto something in the bomb bay just as those doors broke and the weapon fell. So he was left dangling, holding on, as beneath his feet, the South Carolina rural countryside went past at, you know, 10 or 15,000 feet. He was able to climb back into the plane. But this is just one more incident that shows it's very complicated to maintain control of any of these technologies. Accidents happen, people make mistakes, but the margin of error with nuclear weapons is very, very small.
That's right. Were you able to talk to that pilot?
No, I never was. Yeah. I never was. I got his account through the accident report and through contemporary news reports on it. This is this was another nuclear weapons accident that was very difficult to hide because suddenly there's a huge explosion in this family's yard, and they were taken to the hospital, and suddenly there were guys in radiation suits wandering around their property. So, you know, that's an instance in which the military truthfully said, they said in that incident, there was never any chance that the weapon would detonate, and they were right. But there were other times they said there was no chance of the weapon detonating when they weren't being entirely truthful.
Right. Now, as John says, you talked to a lot of people in researching this book, and I just want to say your book is about 500 pages and then another 150 pages of notes and acknowledgments, and it's really a just staggering amount of work that you did here. And so I'm wondering, in the work and in the research, did you find that you were pleased to see that since Damascus happened, you know, 33 years ago, that things have gotten safer? Or were you dismayed, I'm thinking may have been your finding, that that this stuff still goes on, needless accidents?
You know, one quick comment on those notes. The notes are extensive, and readers don't have to feel obligated to look through them, but I felt it was important not to rely on unnamed sources,
right,
not to have people accept some of these incredible assertions, you know, on, you know, just take it from me. But because there's been so much secrecy, because the government has tried so hard to keep this information away from the public, I felt like my work should be transparent, and people, readers, should be able to see exactly where the information came from and track it down for themselves. You know, I came away having met so many of these officers, weapons designers. I came away in one way encouraged by the patriotism of these people, by their personal courage, by their very sincere effort to devoting their lives to preventing these accidents and to preventing nuclear war. So, you know, I didn't meet any crazy warmongering generals who wanted to nuke the Soviets. I found a lot of patriotic, hardworking people for whom I have enormous admiration, and I write about that in the book. But I did come away concerned, still, to this day, about the management of our nuclear weapons. The weapons themselves are much safer. I write about how modern nuclear weapon safety devices have been invented, and so the weapons themselves are safer. But it's still a real challenge. I mean, just this summer, two of our three strategic missile wings have been cited for safety violations. The largest storage facility for nuclear weapons that the Air Force runs, everyone who worked in that squadron was decertified, basically taken off the job a few years ago for safety violations. Our weapons are aging. Our land-based missiles were deployed in the 1970s, which means they're many of them are close to 40 years old. A lot of the infrastructure, the cables, the equipment that controls them is 30, 40 years old. And we can argue about should we have nuclear weapons or how many should we have, but having done the research I've done, if we're going to have them, we should spare no expense in how we manage them. We should spare no expense in how we compensate the people who oversee them, and we need to make sure that they're very well trained and very highly motivated. And so I still have concerns about the system.
Eric, there seems to be a tremendous amount of talk today about terrorism, and there's certainly too much talk today about the Kardashians.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of people talking about the dangers of nuclear weapons. Why is that?
Well, one of the great miraculous events of history was the collapse of the Soviet Union without a Third World War. When I was growing up, I'm 54, when I was growing up, it was inconceivable that the Soviet Union would vanish from the earth, that the Berlin Wall would come down, that Germany would be reunited without a world war, without thousands or even millions of people dying for that to happen. And most people thought those things would never happen. The Berlin Wall was a permanent fixture of the European landscape. And one of the things that happened is there was so much jubilation and so much joy at these wonderful things happening. People forgot that these nuclear weapons are still out there, thousands of them, ready to be used in the United States, in Russia today, in China. And now that we're, 20-plus years on from the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's an entire generation that has no knowledge of nuclear weapons.
Is this one of the reasons?
Remember the existential threat and dread that so many people felt in the Cold War, literally, the thought that a war might come any day that could destroy all of mankind. Half the American population either wasn't born or were small children when the Soviet Union collapsed. So there's a lack of memory, there's a lack of awareness of these issues, and I think global warming and nuclear weapons are the two greatest threats that this country faces, and we need to have much more discussion, much more awareness, and much more debate, not only about our nuclear arsenal and its potential problems, but also about how to reduce the number of nuclear weapons throughout the world. It's just of urgent importance.
So this is one of the reasons that you wrote the book, because these conversations really are not taking place the way they should.
That's right. And the book isn't a diatribe. It's not a rant, arguing one point of view about what we should do about nuclear weapons. I tried to write it in a very calm, straightforward, factual way. It's the story of this one accident told in great detail, because I think there's all kinds of important implications from this accident, and it's also, an amazing story. And then I go through other aspects of our nuclear weapons enterprise factually to provide information to readers that the government has not wanted people to have, and particularly in the Cold War, did not want people to have.
Eric, I hope you'll take this as a compliment, because it's meant as one, but you kind of remind me of John Krakauer on steroids.
Well, he's a great writer. So I'll take that. Thank you very much.
And you know why I'm saying this? Because John Krakauer picks something that he doesn't know a lot about, but he's interested in, and he just goes into it, which is what you've done here. But the steroids part is that, wow, you've gone into it with such intensity. And this is where I want to tie in a little bit of talk about Reefer Madness and Fast Food Nation. I mean, so you go from the proliferation of fast food to, in Reefer Madness, porn and marijuana and strawberries, to this book, Command and Control about nuclear weapons. And so, to tie them all together, there is this theme, and the theme is warning the world, the public, about things that are very real threats.
There's also another theme of powerful bureaucracies that don't want the public to know the truth. In investigating the fast food industry, we've all been eating that food all our lives, but these companies just didn't want you to know how they were made, what they do to your body, what they were doing to agriculture or the landscape around us. In writing about the war on drugs, the misinformation, the disinformation, the lies about marijuana, in order to, fuel this war on drugs. And in this case, there was a need for secrecy, and there is a need for secrecy about certain aspects of nuclear weapons. But we've had way too much secrecy. And when you have as much secrecy as we've had, what happens is you have a small... I'm talking to you from Washington, D.C. right now. You have a small group of policymakers, mainly in Washington, D.C., making fundamental decisions about life and death involving nuclear weapons without any public scrutiny, without any public debate or involvement. Mm-hmm. And I'm a great believer that, these decisions are too important to be left to a handful of people to be made in secret. And that's one of the reasons the book was written.
Now, has enough change happened since Fast Food Nation and Reefer Madness that you feel that there's hope for change after this book?
I am not apocalyptic, and I am not overwhelmed by a sense of impending doom, because if I was, I would not have spent 6 years of my life researching nuclear weapons.
Right.
I would have gone, you know, hiking and enjoyed the final days before the apocalypse came. I am absolutely convinced that change is possible. I mean, there were no New York publishers that wanted to publish Fast Food Nation. I felt like these issues were so important, and I couldn't get a publisher.
Wow.
And, you know, 12 years on, so many of the issues that that book dealt with are now mainstream
Absolutely.
Issues of debate. And I'm not taking credit for it. I'm just saying I've seen the change in the popular culture. Right now, the state of Washington and Colorado have legalized marijuana, which was inconceivable
yep.
to me when I was writing Reefer Madness, about people getting life sentences without parole for marijuana offenses. And one of the most successful popular movements in the history of the United States was the nuclear freeze movement, which began in the late 1970s, which was responsible for the largest political demonstration in American history, Central Park, almost a million people demonstrating against nuclear weapons. And it really affected, I think, Ronald Reagan and really helped persuade him to support the abolition of nuclear weapons. It's quite remarkable that Reagan, of all people, became an ardent opponent of nuclear weapons. So I think in order for any of these changes to happen, there needs to be public awareness of what's going on, and I feel like that's my job.
Eric, we want to thank you for being on the show this morning. There's a tremendous amount of buzz for this book, a lot of people talking about it, and we want to wish you the very best of luck.
Thank you very much. Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Yeah. Eric Schlosser, who is the author of Commanding and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety.
And you're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We're going to talk about crows. Crows gather around their dead and warn of impending doom, among other things. We'll be talking with University of Utah Professor of Wildlife Science, John Marsluff. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Jan, I think I'm falling for the show.
John, are you hurt?
Nothing a little fun can't cure.
Fall into Fun on Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m.
Find out on Fun Friday what to do this fall. Brought to you by All Seasons Adventures, Zermatt Resort and Spa.
And the Homestead Resort.
No hosts were hurt in the making of this ad.
Hi, this is Jan Williams. KPCW is recruiting for the Volunteer Air Force. It's open enrollment for volunteer DJ opportunities. If you're interested in being a part of your community and KPCW, contact me, jwilliams@kpcw.org. The KPCW Volunteer Air Force wants you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our next guest this morning is John Marsluff, Professor of Wildlife Science at the University of Washington. John studied the behavior of crows and his research on the intelligence and startling abilities of crows. He offers an in-depth look at these complex creatures and the traits and behaviors that we share, including language, delinquency, frolic, passion, wrath, risk-taking, and awareness. Crows gather around their dead. They warn of impending doom. They recognize people. They commit murder of other crows. They lure animals to their death. They swill coffee. And, hey, what's so wrong with drinking beer? They drink beer. They design and use tools, including cars as nutcrackers. They also windsurf and sled to play. John, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, John and Lynn. Great to be here.
Yeah. What drew you to study crows?
Well, actually, kind of an accident. I was studying a close relative of theirs, the pinion jay, and the nest I was watching was robbed by a pair of crows, came in and stole the eggs out of the nest. And that was challenging for me as a observer of the jays, but it shed new light on these birds and their other relatives like the ravens.
And in my neighborhood, we have a lot of magpies, and they seem to exhibit the same aggressive behavior as far as other birds' nests.
Yeah, magpies are in the same family. They're all in the family of corvids, they're called, and they're nest robbers and opportunistic predators, but they're also incredibly engaging and smart, and they're really animals that motivate us.
And of all the research that you've done over the years, what was the most surprising thing that you learned about the corvids?
It's hard to narrow it down to one. It seems like every day I get another story from somebody of an amazing thing they did. I guess, you know, personally, some of the most amazing things to me is their ability to recognize me as a researcher and my students. And the way we tested this was actually when we typically study our birds, we have to catch them and tag them so we can identify them as individuals and follow their unique behaviors and trajectories through life. And when we do that, we have to hold them, and it's a stressful period for the birds as we capture them with a net and tag them and let them go on their way. And so we decided we would do that one time wearing a mask so that we could then test the response of the birds to that mask or somebody else wearing that mask later on. And what we found was that the birds, after they've been captured by a particular person, they recognize that person and continue to scold and harass that person every time they see him for now going on 8 years after that person hasn't harmed them at all during the intervening time. And in fact, most of the birds that are now know about a dangerous person like this, they never actually personally experienced the threat of this person. They just see others responding in a fearful way to it or an aggressive way. So that ability to recognize and discriminate and to remember for such a long time an act like that kind of humbles you in that respect, and it amazes me.
It is pretty amazing, John, and I'm thinking all our listeners right now are thinking about, because we do have so many magpies here in Park City, they're sure. Thinking about how the magpies do. It's almost like they seek revenge on you in some way, and they pester you and they bug you, and it is actually personal.
It's personal. There's no doubt magpies recognize individuals, and if you've harmed them or somehow threatened them, even in a way you don't know, maybe you just walked by a young magpie at some point when it couldn't fly very well, and its parents immediately saw you as a threat, and they're going to label you, and they're going to remember that for years. But they also remember good deeds. Mm-hmm. There's a great story of a magpie that was fed by a guy in Idaho, and he put mice out in his barn every evening for the magpies the next morning, and they'd come in and take the mice, and they would often leave him nice little gifts, shiny glass and other neat objects.
Wow. They stopped short of a thank you note.
Well, yeah, they don't know how to write yet, but they're working on it, I'm sure.
So what are the other traits or characteristics of this classification of a corvid?
Well, you know, there are, first off, they're one of the songbirds, and that includes about half of all of the birds, and that's a particular designation that's given to birds that have a complex throat musculature that allows them to vocalize typically the great songs we hear, but also complex calls like the magpies and crows and ravens use. So that physical distinction puts them into that branch of all birds, and then within the songbirds, the corvids are ones, they all have a common ancestor. It was some sort of a early crow type of ancestor. And they have that in common, and they share some traits such as kind of a general physique, not a very specialized beak, for example, but one that can do a lot of different things, pry and poke and probe and all of these sorts of actions. Very generalized body plan. You know, nothing particularly unique there, but unique in being general and being able to take advantage of many different situations. So that's the basic distinction, is that they all have a common ancestor that shares, you know, a genetic heritage back to some of the early songbirds.
John, when they are getting ready to go into some sort of mobbing type scenario, do they use song to communicate that? Or actually, if you could just talk about mobbing a little bit and tell us how they communicate that.
Sure. So what we mean by mobbing, first off, is the attraction of others into a dangerous place or a dangerous situation. The idea for bringing other individuals into potentially harm's way is that you might be able to change that situation, move the danger away. So you often see magpies or crows and ravens do this with respect to a predator, such as a coyote perhaps in Park City, or a hawk or an eagle, and they'll dive down and come very close to that individual, trying to move it out to basically make the area around there safer for all the individuals there, including themselves. So it's a selfishly motivated behavior, but it gains strength in having others join in on that behavior. It's contagious, as we call it. And so by giving particular calls, the alarm call or scolding calls, you know, a harsh, rapid, rah, 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 the other birds hear that and they come in response to that, knowing there's danger afoot. And it's a very simple communication signal. It's graded in intensity, so more dangerous things get louder and more rapid scolding behavior. But all the birds come in response to that. Even individuals of other species recognize this call, and they come in and join in the mob and scolding, because the more individuals that are in the mob, the greater the chance of the danger leaving and all the birds in the area being safe.
And when it comes to the predator of the hawk, they're oftentimes successful with this scolding strategy, aren't they?
The crows are, in
the crows
terms of
are.
Moving the hawk out, yes. Occasionally it costs, and occasionally the hawk or the coyote reaches up and grabs the individual crow or magpie that's gotten too close and kills it. So there's a real cost to it, and because of that cost, it's also used as a social signaling device. The most dominant members of the crow society or magpie society are the ones who try to get closest, showing off to the others that they are stealthy enough to pull this dangerous act off.
John, I'm wondering, as you've gleaned more and more information from observing crows and ravens and magpies, do you see more how calculated they are in their moves? Is that what comes up for you? These guys they really have some forethought and calculation.
They do, and I think it's also easy to almost read too much into these animals. They do anticipate things dramatically. But what I've come to appreciate is that they learn so quickly from their experiences and then hold on to those experiences and use them in the future whenever it pays off, that accounts for an awful lot of what looks to be quite insightful and foresightful sorts of behavior. So, for example, if you feed birds at a regular time, like happened at the zoo here near Seattle, they would feed their penguins at 10 o'clock on Fridays, and they'd feed them live fish. Well, the crows caught on to this right away, and they would gather a few minutes before 10 o'clock on Fridays, and not at other times, waiting for the keeper to come out with the fish, and then they'd grab most of the fish before the penguins even got them. So they learned that, and it seems like they're anticipating, and they are, but they've learned a quick association between some time and some activity that pays off for them. And then they use that religiously from that point out.
So, John, as a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington, you observe a lot of animals and birds. And do you find, I mean, obviously you've focused in on this area of corvids. Is it because no one else was doing it or because you are fascinated?
It's certainly my fascination. There are other people that are doing it. Kevin McGowan at Cornell has been studying crows longer than I have and really knows individual behavior of these birds extremely well. What I've tried to focus in on is the variety of ways these animals influence me and the rest of us. And I think that's what's fascinating to me, is that these animals, not only are they interesting behaviorally and smart and adaptable, they can live with us unlike most animals do. They can take advantage of us unlike most animals do. And they motivate us, our language, our culture, our beliefs, and art, unlike other animals. So they really have a wide-ranging interaction with people. And it's that interaction that really intrigues me, is how we respond to them and they in turn respond to us, how that influences our beliefs about nature and our interactions with nature, as well as the ecology of the birds.
So this is what you refer to as coevolution?
Yes. The learned social behaviors of the birds is what we can refer to as a biologist, as culture in another species. And that learned social behavior, like the recognition and passing on of the dangerous person that captured them here on our campus, that becomes a tradition or a cultural norm in a population. And that's influenced tremendously by the birds' interactions with us, And in turn, our culture is being influenced by our interaction with them.
Okay. What studies do you have coming up or that you're doing right now that show interest?
Yeah, what we're looking at now is their response primarily to finding a dead conspecific. And when crows find another dead crow or see a crow killed, they again respond with this mobbing sort of behavior. And we're trying to understand why they do that. Is it some kind of a grief ceremony, or is it some kind of a arena for learning? And the way we're trying to get more insight into this is to actually scan the brain activity of the birds as they're participating in these sorts of behaviors. And with colleagues over in the med school, we've been able to tap into some scanning technology that allows us to see the activity in the different parts of the bird's brain while it's actually behaving. We don't have to have them unconscious in a MRI scanner, for example. We can allow them to metabolize a radioactive tracer and then scan after they've behaved to see what part of their brain was active during the behavior.
John,
and what we're learning is that it really seems that this scolding and mobbing behavior around a dead individual isn't motivated so much by grief or concern, but much more by a learning opportunity. Their hippocampus is very active during that particular behavior, which suggests they're learning about the place or the individuals around and involved in this particular death.
Well, that's fascinating. John, yeah. We want to thank you so much for your time this morning. John Marzloff, Professor of Wildlife Science at the University of Washington. And best of luck with your current research and continue to write these articles. They're fascinating.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Okay.
And that was Professor John Marzloff. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. We'll be back in just a moment with Neil Patwari and Brad Major, two of University of Utah electrical engineers. They'll talk about a device they've invented. Cool Science Radio, stay with us.
Many know that Botox can help with migraines, but don't know where to turn for qualified headache care. Locally, Dr. Andy Talbot can help ease the life-altering headaches with Botox treatment. Park City Spine and Pain Clinic is an Intermountain healthcare facility with highly skilled pain management providers. If migraines are a concern, they can help at 435-658-7470. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and this green earth. Rocky Mountain Power Watt Smart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, wattsmart.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, our next guests this morning are Neil Patwari and Brad Mager, two University of Utah electrical engineers who have developed a network of wireless sensors that can detect a person falling. Now, these sensors are similar to those used in home wireless networks, as each sensor in the array transmits to another. Anyone who's standing or falling inside the network alters the path of signals sent between each pair of sensors. This is a perfect application for people age 65 and older, where falling is the leading cause of injury and death. And we're happy to be joined by these two engineers from the University of Utah. Good morning to you, Neil and Brad. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So first of all, let us distinguish at first sight, talking about your device here. We know that there already have been devices that can help the elderly when they fall. So maybe give a little history of what's already on the market, and then we'll get into what you two have invented.
Go ahead, Brad.
Well, a lot of the fall detection systems are wearable devices, as you know. So they involve things like a gyroscope or accelerometer that can detect when a body falls, or they might have a push-button device that a person then would press to call for help after they've fallen. And so we want to be able to create a system that doesn't involve a need to wear a device.
Okay, so you don't need to wear a device. How does it appear then? What is it?
Neil, you want to go ahead?
Sure. So what we're using is radio waves to detect somebody falling. And radio waves are the things that we use when we, you know, our wireless devices communicate. And instead of using that for communication, we're using it to detect a body. And a body is a, you know, it has an effect on the electromagnetic wave and usually causes it to attenuate because we're a lot of water and radio waves don't really go through water. So what we have done is we've developed these network devices to act as a sensor in order to detect the presence of a body.
Okay, and to draw the distinction between the wearable device and the network solution that you all have come up with, one of the main distinctions is that I believe I've read that over 80% of the elderly that have wearable devices, they don't wear them.
Yeah, for many reasons, these devices don't get used, even if somebody owns one. And predominantly, it's just that people don't like wearing them, and so they hang them on a chair or they, you know, leave them on a wall. And when they fall, they're not in reach of that device, and so they can't, the device can't detect the fall if it's not being worn, and they can't push a button if the button is too far away.
So we have the distinction that you have a solution that does not have to be worn and that will always be monitoring if they are, if they fall or not. And I believe another distinction is, and correct me if I'm wrong, with the wearable devices, they don't detect a slouching type situation, whereas yours would if they were to, let's say, be sitting at a table and have a stroke and start slouching down, your device would be able to detect that.
What we've done so far is primarily detect somebody lying down on the ground. And what we try to do is we try to detect how quickly they've changed from some other position to lying down on the ground, with the idea that if that happens too quickly, that's probably something that's unsafe.
Right. And you both have started a company to start marketing this product?
Well, that was Neil's company.
Oh, I have a former PhD student, and I are involved in a startup company called Xandom that commercializes RF sensing technologies. And so we're actively trying to develop this into a product, and Brad is involved with that as well.
Okay, so at what stage of development is your product?
Well, we have a what's called an SBIR grant. It's a Small Business Innovative Research grant from the National Science Foundation, and that's a six-month grant where we are taking the ideas that Brad has presented in this paper. And we're developing it to be, you know, to work and make sure that it's 100% robust and think about things dealing with the commercialization of the technology that you know, go beyond just the technology.
So we have to make it more practical, easy to use, cost-effective, all those kinds of things that we have to consider.
Okay, so once you have gotten to this point, how is this installed in a house?
Well, we have a number of these sensor nodes, or just small devices, and they will transmit and receive the radio signals. And so these would be placed around a house or in a room, and so we're trying to get them to as few as possible. So there might be anywhere 16 to 24 of these for a house or apartment. They would then need to be powered, and they have one of these sensors is receiving the signals from all the others and then goes to essentially a processing device that would then process the data to determine what the situation is in terms of where the person is and whether a fall has happened.
What are the other applications for this technology?
Well, we see it as being, since we're able to use it to know where a person is located in a room or in an environment, we can use it also for some contextual awareness, we call it. So we kind of keep track of person's activities, and so able to monitor them. Not so much in a Big Brother kind of way, because I know this can sound frightening, but for people who are living alone and there's a caregiver who can't be there at all times, just wants to know how the person is doing.
Very interesting.
Great application, really. Yeah. You know, we've been really impressed with everyone we've talked to on this show out of the University of Utah. Of course, we know that the engineering department there is very noted nationwide. And, you know, just wondering, Neil, you're a professor of electrical engineering, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, and Brad, what's your role?
I'm a student there. I'm now a grad student getting a master's in computer engineering.
Okay. Do all grad students come up with things as cool as this? Or, you know, is this a commonplace thing to come out of the engineering department?
It seems that there are a lot of really cool ideas that people come up with and work on for their projects or their senior theses. So I'd say, yeah.
We part of our student experience is to have students working on projects and to develop things on their own, and develop it as an engineer would. And so our seniors all do a senior project, either individually or in teams, and they, you know, take problems that local industry has or, you know, industry anywhere in the country. They take the problems that they see, and they try to develop solutions that will work, you know, both from a technical standpoint and perhaps from a commercial standpoint.
It's really neat to see the whole process, you know, taking it through each stage all the way through. Maybe need to pass it on to the marketing department down there as well. And, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is, have you come up with a final name for this product?
Oh, we don't.
Are you going to wait till you sell it to the big conglomerate that does
home
wireless?
Somebody else will be much smarter at coming up with a name than the engineers.
Do you have a nickname? You must call it something. Fall down and I can't get up? Or
that's covered.
That's covered, right.
Call it our fall detection system.
Yeah.
Okay.
And by the way, are you patenting this device?
We filed an invention disclosure form with the University of Utah, and which is something that that we do here as employees of the university. And the university went ahead and filed a provisional patent application.
Okay. Well, Brad Megger, graduate student at the University of Utah, along with Neil Patwari, professor in the engineering department at the University of Utah, thank you so much for your time today. It's a very interesting invention.
Thank you.
And this is Cool Science Radio. Right here on KPCW, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Local programming all day. Only in Park City, only on KPCW, 91.9 FM in Park City and the Heber Valley, 88.1 FM in Colville and Camas. This is KPCW Park City.
Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with John Wells. We want to thank our guest today, writer Eric Schlosser, and Professor John Marsliff with the Crows, along with Neil Patwari and Brad Megger from University of Utah.
We also want to thank our underwriters, 350 Main and The Spur, San Francisco Design, and Prudential Real Estate. Please join us next week on Cool Science Radio.
And as always, you can go to kpcw.org, look up programs and Cool Science Radio, and you can listen to archive shows. You're listening to KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.